Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Cory Booker has an impressive resume: Stanford, Yale, a Rhodes Scholar. His resume also has a few twists. He moved into a housing project in Newark's inner city. He once slept in a tent near drug dealers. He staged a 10-day hunger strike. Always, he fights for what he believes in, first as a city councilor, mayor of Newark, and now a United States senator. He has his sights on a new job, president, this hour. On Point, Senator Cory Booker makes the case why he's the best choice for the Oval Office. Join us. What do you want to know from Cory Booker? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook, where they're at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at cities under attack by hackers. But first, with us from Washington is Democratic presidential candidate Senator Cory Booker. It's great to have you with us, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. It's good to be on.
So you have such a compelling personal story, Senator, beyond the professional accomplishments and the Ivy League education. I'd like to start by asking you just to introduce yourself to our listeners. Who is Cory Booker?
God. First of all, thank you for having me on. And second of all, look, I'm a guy that grew up in the 80s with parents who literally had to fight a sort of a racist housing segregation. They got this incredible group of mostly white activists who let real estate agents pose as them. Let the couples pose as them before real estate agents after my parents were denied housing to have my brother and I grow up in an incredible neighborhood. In fact, on the day of the closing, the white couple who went through the entire process for my parents after my parents were told the house was sold, the white couple didn't show up. My father did in a lawyer, and the real estate agent then attacked the lawyer, punched him in the face, sicked a dog on my dad. So imagine me growing up in the 80s with the parents who just told me, you're here not just because of the hard work and grit of your parents, but you're here because of American patriots who understood that patriotism is love of country, and you can't love your country without loving your fellow countrymen and women. And love isn't a sentiment, isn't a feel-good thing. Love means that if your kids don't have access to great public schools and great housing, then my kids are lesser off. Love says I need to sacrifice and stand with you, that we're all in this together. And so I just grew up in a household with two black civil rights activists who had this patriotic love of our country and a belief that their boys, my brother and I, should grow up not just to luxuriate in the blessings that were given to us by other generations, but feel the sense of obligation that you had to – you couldn't pay it back. You had to pay it forward. So as soon as I got out of law school, I went to inner city Newark, New Jersey to become a housing rights lawyer because people fought for my housing rights. I was going to pay it forward by fighting for others. And I fell in love with that community. I still live in this neighborhood now. And it was this neighborhood that first took a chance on me and said, there is a corrupt city hall and it doesn't serve the people, and we're going to run you for city councilman. So by the time I was in my 20s, I was running against the machine in an impossible race. And we ended up upsetting the machine. And I became the youngest person at that time ever elected in my city and began a life of purpose. I always say life is about purpose, not position. But the purpose really is to fight for so many communities that are being left out of the American dream or looked down upon or cast aside. And I was just proud to have sort of lived my life with that sense of purpose. And it leads me to this presidential race today.
So with 24 other Democrats running for president, I lose track. There's so many. I'll be crowded field here. I mean, why you? Give us the short version. Why do you want to be president?
Well, really, two things. First of all, my resume is very unique. There's I don't think anybody in this race that was really the chief executive of the largest city in their state and a United States senator that in a divided time with Congress often not getting things done actually led major bipartisan bills like the most recent First Step Act, which is the first time since all these horrible 80s and 90s crime bills that just led to mass incarceration, the first bill that begins to unwind that. But it's more than that. I'm running because I think we as a nation are falling into deeper and deeper tribalism where we have politics that's us versus them, zero-sum game, fear-based politics, where we have more animus and anger directed at each other than we do at foreign adversaries that are actively trying to undermine our election. that we're failing to get the kind of things done that, frankly, many Americans agree on, from infrastructure investment to common sense gun safety to meeting the challenges of climate change. We need in this nation to form a new American majority. And that's not just Democrats. That means moderates and independents and Republicans. We've got to get back to a country that can get things done. And my whole career has been marching and charging at running towards some of the most difficult problems in America and finding ways to create new coalitions to get things done. We need a president that can heal, that can bring people together, that can get us back. We have so much common pain in this country, can get us back to a sense of common purpose and common cause.
One of the themes that I hear you speak of often beyond that is economic justice, this idea that the U.S. economy just doesn't work for every American anymore. And you've proposed some interesting things to try to combat that. One is this idea of baby bonds, where you put $1,000 into a savings account and every year the government adds to it, with lower income Americans getting more. And then by the time a child is 18 or so, you have, you know, $40,000 or $50,000 to be used for education, among other things. Do you propose this as a way to sort of narrow the racial wealth gap in this country? How do you see this?
Yeah, all of the above. I mean, we come from generations who had this bold idea that, hey, we're going to create Social Security or Medicare, things that give people in this country as a birthright in order to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We need to have systems that give people that kind of security and economic empowerment. And we have a tax system that right now gives so much of its $700 billion to people who already have wealth, gives them tax benefits to create more wealth from the income, from the mortgage income deduction to different tax breaks for people who are saving for retirement, people with money, helping them get breaks to create more money. But we don't do that for so many struggling people. And I believe that as a birthright in this country, we should use some of our tax code to help people without money to get a fair start. And so this baby bonds idea, which is actually coming from think tanks on both sides of the aisle. Number one, a kid just having a interest-bearing account, knowing that it's there, increases their likelihood of going to college three times. And so we think every kid as a birthright in America should have $1,000 in an interest-bearing account. And depending on your family's income, you can have upwards of $2,000 deposited into that account. And so the lowest income kids, by the time they're 18, will have upwards of $50,000 to invest in education, college, or buy a home, or do the things that create wealth. Because we know in America, paychecks usually help you get by, but wealth helps you get ahead. Now, the benefit of this, which we knew from our design, means that because we have such disparities in income along racial lines, that you would actually see the average black kid, because poverty is more represented, get about $30,000, while the average white kid would get a little more than half of that. And so, as Columbia University says, this is actually one of those bills. In fact, it's the only one I know of in America that would give every kid a fighting chance, whether you're poor and a white kid from Appalachia or inner city kid from Camden. But what it says is that because it's an equal playing field for all children, it would virtually eliminate the racial wealth gap against for kids in America. And that's an incredible benefit in a nation where we have, I mean, Boston, the average white family has, in terms of wealth, about $240,000. The average black family has about $8. That becomes very baked in societies where we now have, where work doesn't pay as much as it used to, where we've had stagnant wages, where you see people playing by the rules, working hard, catching extra shifts, but just not getting ahead. This begins to give every American a better foundation to stand upon and address a lot of these long-standing racial disparities.
A lot of questions from our listeners, Senator Cory Booker. Carrie on Twitter asks, do you support Bernie Sanders' plan to cancel all student loan debt? Why or why not?
Well, look, we have a massive crisis in education, and the crippling debt that so many children are young people are facing is affecting life decisions. It is, I think, competitively hurting us, because other nations now, Germany 0 to 4% of median income to go to college, Canada 6 to 7%, and the United States between 50 and 60% of median income. And that's why I am sponsoring bills to do everything from debt-free college to also believing that we should end the profiteering that the federal government does off the backs of folks. But I don't believe we should cancel unilaterally all debt. I think that that is extremely costly. It's canceling debt for people that are of higher income brackets or going into jobs, whether they're large corporate jobs or Wall Street jobs that are going to give them the ability to pay back their money. Why would we use our money to cancel their debt when we should be doing is having plans to help folks who really need it and cancel the debt for public school teachers, for public defenders, people going into public service provisions, doing things to help people. And I have a plan to help people be able to adjust their interest rates to make their college loans a lot more affordable and to reduce their cost payments. But some of the plans I see out there that are sort of indiscriminate, I think they're would end up giving a lot of money to wealthy people who just don't need it.
I have a lot of questions for you about immigration and gun control and prescription drug prices. A lot of our listeners are waiting on the phones. I just have a minute or so before the break, though, Senator Cory Booker. I guess I wonder about these two different breeds of Democratic candidates that seem to be out there this season. The feisty progressives like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the let's make nice Democrats like Joe Biden, for example. I'm curious, to your mind, what brand does the country need right now? What do you think Democrats can offer? What does this country need in, as far as a personality to put forth in this country?
Well, first of all, I let's stay away from these broad-based labels. As the only person in the United States Senate that lives in a low-income, below-the-poverty-line, black and brown community, a lot of your listeners right now just feel a sense of urgency, dissatisfaction, and even anger about what's happening to our society as a whole, where folks who play by the rules get hurt, where, you know, I live in a neighborhood where kids drink out of plastic bottles in their schools because we have a nation with so many more. 3,000 kids have a higher rates of lead poisoning in their blood than Flint, Michigan. We just need people with a sense of urgency that can bring this country together to solve problems. And that's the kind of leader I intend to be able to unite our party and other Americans to the urgent cause of justice.
We're speaking with Senator Cory Booker about his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. And you can join the conversation, listeners. Is he your pick? What resonates for you in his message, his life story? We'll be back after the break with Senator Cory Booker. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're speaking with Senator Cory Booker this hour. He's one of a crowded field of Democrats running for president. And listeners, we'd love to have you join us. What's your number one issue in this election? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Senator Booker, one of our listeners, Ron, in Bowling Green, Kentucky, had a question about immigration. So I wanted to ask you about that. Last week, you crossed the southern border with a group of migrant women who were seeking asylum in the United States. You've been very vocal on this issue. You recently unveiled your immigration plan, which aims to virtually eliminate immigration detention, as I understand it. You want to move the focus away from charging migrants with criminal offenses unless they pose a threat to public safety. I'm curious how you see this. President Trump campaigned on the opposite message and won. Do you think Americans are hungry for your point of view? Do you think they support decriminalizing immigration at this point?
Yeah, look, as a mayor of a city, I used to end up always saying, in God we trust, but everybody else bring me data. In other words, I just wanted to see what was working. And sometimes that was counterintuitive to folks, that how we moved the efficiency and effectiveness of our city. Well, I looked at our immigration system and I realized that we are violating. There's a moral vandalism going on. And you see a president that uses the racist, demeaning terms when he even talks about immigrants. But if you start looking at what our common goals are, the safety and security of our borders, the affirmation of human rights and human dignity, the understanding that immigration is actually our strength economically, we came up with a plan based upon evidence-based interventions that actually work better. And so we know that when you criminalize the crossings, that means that you're doing this, you're taking tremendous resources to incarcerate people, to warehouse them, that begins to compound the problems of what we're seeing at the border right now. Well, I know that if you do it through the civil system, you free up resources. There's evidence-based models like case managers working with immigrants and immigrant families has actually a higher, almost 100% rate of those immigrant families then coming to their court hearings and going through the process. You can do it at a fraction of the cost of this detention. You can affirm human rights and human dignity, and you can keep our community safe and actually do what the law requires, which if somebody's coming here seeking asylum, as I saw with these five women that I escorted into the country who were survivors of sexual violence, survivors of just horrific assaults on their humanity, that we can actually have a system that achieves our common goals and our common purpose. This is a president that traffics in fear and demagoguery and hate when it comes to immigration, whipping it up in ways that are unnecessary, that are costly, not only costing us our safety and security and our resources, but really you cannot assault the dignity of another human without yourselves, your country's dignity being assaulted as well.
Let me get Marcus in here from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Marcus. You're on the air with Senator Cory Booker.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Senator, I work in the inner city in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm a Caucasian male. I would just like to say thank you for the story that you told in your memoir about the elderly woman who asked you to describe what you see around you.
Yes.
And how that was so transformative. I have relayed that story so many times, and I am absolutely grateful beyond all belief for you sharing that story with us.
Thank you very much. And just to summarize it real quickly, I always say I got my BA from Stanford, but my PhD on the streets of Newark. And my community has had some of the wisest souls. And a lot of times people look at inner city communities or Appalachian communities, factory town, they look down on them. And when I came there with this sort of complex where I was going to help save this community very quickly, in fact, my whole book, United, is really about the lessons, the hard lessons I got. And this was a woman who just said, describe the neighborhood. And I said, if you want to help me, you got to describe my neighborhood. And I talked about the crack house that lived where I lived next to, or the abandoned buildings. And the more I talked, the more upset she just seemed. And then she just says, you can't help me. And she starts walking away. And I stop her and I go, what are you talking about? And she says to me, boy, understand that the world you see outside of you is a reflection of what you have inside of you. And if you're one of those people who only see problems and darkness and despair, that's all there's ever going to be, and you can't help me. But if you're one of those stubborn people that every time you open your eyes, you see hope, you see possibility, you see love, you see the face of God in my community, then you can be one of those people that helps me. And I tell you, she's one of the most influential figures in my life, and it's why I still live in that neighborhood now. And we're seeing transformative change, a supermarket now in our food desert, a new transformed high school, new parks. All of the things we're seeing now in Newark is because of great visionary leaders who never gave up, had a defiant love. We're seeing them now because they saw them then.
Marcus, thank you so much for that call. Let's go to Jim in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Jim. You're on the air with Senator Cory Booker.
Hi, Senator Booker. What makes you electable against President Trump?
Well, I hope that people learn more about my ascendancy to where I am today. I think I can't say that there's one person in this race who faced more outrageous opposition. In fact, there's an Oscar-nominated documentary about my beating the machine in Newark called Street Fight. It lost to March the Penguins, for crying out loud, in the Oscars. But I have taken on bullies before and beat them. I've taken on impossible fights before and won. And I've done it not by taking on the tactics and techniques of demagogues and bullies, but by calling people to our higher angels, calling to the moral imagination of communities about what we can be and what we can achieve together. We can't beat the darkness with darkness. In fact, I still remember in a town hall meeting right before I was going to take the stage in Iowa, some guy comes up to me and says, "Dude, I want you to punch Donald Trump in the face." And I look at him and I smile and I go, "Dude, that's a felony." We're not going to beat him by using his tactics. We're not going to beat him by fighting him on his turf and his terms. That's exactly what he wants. I'm calling to my party and to my country not to define ourselves by what we're against, but by what we're for. And this idea in the Democratic Party that all we want is somebody that can beat Donald Trump, that gives me chills because I want my country and my party to have bigger aspirations than that. Beating Donald Trump is the floor. It's not the ceiling. Beating him gets us out of the valley, but it doesn't get us to the mountaintop. What will get us there is finding ways to rebuild a more beloved community, to help us to come together, to stand together, and to rise together. And that's the difficult work we have in our nation right now, where we can't even get the things we agree on done. So I can beat Donald Trump. I hope you'll learn more about me. But we have to, as a country, find ways to repair the fabric of our communities and get back to the ideals of a more beloved community to solve our problems.
Jim, thank you for the call. One more, Senator Booker, from Lucy in Lexington, Massachusetts. Lucy, welcome to the program. Just a couple of minutes with the senator here. Go ahead with your question.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Senator Booker. I'm one of many patriotic American women still working hard after the loss in 2016 to get a qualified, capable woman candidate elected president. So I just wanted to ask, will you be putting a woman on your ticket?
So first of all, I'm with you. I fought hard, harder than I think of in any election, to have a woman be the president right now. And I'm deeply disappointed that there is not one. And I believe we are at a point in our nation where we should never have a ticket again that doesn't have diversity, gender diversity, racial diversity. So should I be the nominee, I will have a woman on my ticket, not because of some kind of window dressing, because diverse teams are stronger teams, that we need to bring the best of our party together in all of our tickets. And I know as a guy who has always fought, even in the Senate when I got there, the gender diversity in on Senate staff, Senate Democrat staffs, racial diversity was not what it should be. And I work with Chuck Schumer to have every Democratic senator now literally have to publish the diversity stats on their staffs. And it's led to more diversity in hiring in the Senate. So I commit to having that gender diversity on my ticket. I commit to having a cabinet and a team around me that reflects the United States of America. And that's going to make us stronger and better going forward.
Lucy, thanks so much for your call. Senator Booker, I want to do a lightning round with you before you go. I know you've got a lot going on today. Just quick answers here, 15 seconds or less, okay?
I'll try.
Yeah, try hard. Your view on gun rights, sir?
If you live in a new neighborhood like mine, or you have lots of shootings that continue to go on every day, we have 100 people. I have the boldest plan of all the people in this race to once and for all end mass shootings, to end the carnage in our country. I have a very personal connection to this issue from my community and my neighborhood, knowing people like Shahad Smith that was murdered with an assault rifle on my block last year. So I'm going to bring a fight to this issue like this nation has never seen before, like the corporate gun lobby and the NRA has never experienced, and we will win this fight.
15 seconds on climate change.
Look, Greenpeace ranks me and Inslee as the two best on climate in this whole crowded field. I haven't just been standing up on this issue in the Senate. I started as a mayor when George Bush wouldn't join the Kyoto Climate Accords and stood up and had told my city that every issue from prisoner reentry to job training, it's going to be focused on climate change. And we transformed a city as a result. And as president of the United States, I will be the best fighter on this issue by making sure everything from our ag bill, transportation sector, even our procurement practices, everything is focused on climate change and dealing with this existential crisis, including foreign policy. It's not just about rejoining the Paris Climate Accords. It is actually about using our trade policy, our billions of dollars of foreign aid. Everything that we do has got to be about getting this planet focused on ending this impending climate crisis.
And the number one thing you will do, Senator Booker, on day one in the White House?
I will begin to do what's necessary to create a climate where we can, again as a nation, do big things. Trust me, my pen is going to be working on lots of stuff. But we as a country, 50 years since we went to the moon, we've got to be a nation that, again, can do big things, that can defy gravity by coming together as a nation. And I will end what this president has done by dividing us, by being a president that unites us in common cause and common purpose.
Senator Cory Booker, U.S. Senator from New Jersey, 2020 Democratic presidential candidate. So nice to have you with us, sir. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
In a moment, listeners, we'll take a look at the cyber attacks wreaking havoc on local governments across the United States. This is On Point. In Lake City, Florida, municipal records, hackers have broken into the city's computers and demanded $460,000 for their return. It's happening all over the country, Atlanta, Baltimore, Dallas, and cities are grappling with whether or not to pay these ransoms. Frances Robles is a correspondent for The New York Times. She's been reporting on this story. She joins us from Key West, Florida. Frances, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So help us understand how widespread these ransom threats are on local governments across the U.S.
Well, it's been going on for years in private companies, hospitals, all kinds of different organizations. What you're starting to see now that's happening more and more is that we're learning about it. And we're learning about it because they're attacking municipal governments. They're attacking ports. They're attacking Department of Transportation in Colorado. And it's the numbers are getting huge and the ransoms are getting huge.
How big?
Oh, $600,000. Mm-hmm. Some of it depends on the price of Bitcoin for that day, because all of the transactions are in Bitcoin so that it's untraceable. And I think that, it started at $100 and $300, and they realized, well, hey, if it's $300, why not $3,000? If not $3,000, why not $300,000? And so that's kind of where we're at now, where there's this point where the ransomware attackers are thinking, all right, what's the number that I can get where the person doesn't say, all right, forget it, that's too high.
So give us a case in point, Lake City, Florida. In your reporting, you say hackers took control of more than 100 years of Lake City's municipal records. Paint a picture for us. What happened?
Well, so there's a vault in Lake City where all of the documents dating back to before the Civil War, every resolution, the minutes to the meetings, everything, all of those documents had already been scanned page by page. And there was kind of a cool little thing where you can go online and say, Wilson Park, and then see all the records about that. This is the resolution from 1972. This is that. All of that is gone, because on Monday, June 10th, when the city officials got to their computers at 7:30 in the morning, there was a little note on their server, and it said, how would you like to open this kind of file? I had two email addresses, and then it was signed, Balance of the Shadow Universe. Hmm. So it took them a moment to say, wait a second, Balance of the Shadow Universe, what does that mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, I wrote to the email addresses over the weekend, just on a whim, like, oh, let's see if they'll answer me. And that's all they answered, a Balance of the Shadow Universe.
You emailed the hackers?
I did. I did it from a separate new email account, because I did check with our IT security people first, because I was not looking to be the cause of a major crippling breakdown at the New York Times.
And all they replied back was their call name or their
That's
ID.
Correct. Mm. That's right.
All right, back to Lake City, Florida. So what was the impact on the people who live there after this ransom attack?
So for the first few days at City Hall, there's a paralysis, chaos, where the computers don't work, the email doesn't work, the phones didn't have any contacts on them, the copy machines didn't work because they were tied to the network, the printers didn't work because they're tied to the network, the backups were unavailable because that was still on the network. And so, you sense that there was some people's kind of sitting around at their desk thinking, well, should I just go home because there's nothing to do? And so they spend, you know, a few weeks just basically trying to figure out how to work without the regular technology that we've grown so accustomed to. So if you went to pay your water bill, you had to pay in cash and you got a receipt that was written out by hand. One thing that did surprise me is that I did expect more chaos in among the residents, you know, people maybe getting their water turned off or things like that. I didn't find too much of that. The chaos seemed to be pretty restricted to City Hall.
So did Lake City pay the hackers' ransom demands?
They did pay. So they did pay.
Okay.
The Florida League of Cities started offering insurance for this about a decade ago. They kind of saw it coming because of it had been hitting private businesses. And so, you know, that's a double-edged sword because, okay, it's great that you have this insurance. And then if you pay, you get a decryption key and you get your records back. But the more that you pay, the more people that are going to get hacked. They wouldn't tell me how much the ransom demand initially was, but whatever it was initially, it was too high. And they were back and forth negotiating. So the negotiation is taking place by the consultants that the Florida League of Cities, the insurer, had hired. So it's not like the city manager is on the phone with, you know, some guy in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, back and forth, and a couple of weeks go by, and so they finally decide, okay, 42 Bitcoin, which at that point was about $460,000, and they got the decryption key. But they got the decryption key, I want to say, I'm trying to think now, my mind is slipping whether it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago at this point, and they don't have everything back.
I was going to say, they haven't recovered all their files.
Yeah, things are decrypted, but that doesn't mean they're in the shape that you want them in. You know, it doesn't mean that cute little searchable database is back online. And so that's the part that is still a work in progress.
We'll talk about the precedent that this all sets for other cities when you actually pay the hackers' ransom demands and what's going on in other big cities across this country. We're discussing hackers attacking local governments. What is the right response? You can join the conversation. Has a ransomware attack hit your town? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're taking a look at the rise of malware attacks on U.S. cities, hospitals, and companies nationwide. And you can join the conversation. Have you lost files, had a hard time paying your utility bill because hackers hit your city? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Here is Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms telling a House Committee on Homeland Security last month that the ransomware attack back in March 2018 in Atlanta left the city, quote, incapacitated.
Some departments and government entities suffered irreparable damage, including our police department, which lost stored dash cam video footage. The Atlanta Municipal Court had to cancel and reschedule hearings. Our customer service interface, known as ATL 311, was knocked offline. Many other applications were impacted or affected, delaying the delivery of city services.
And here is Brett Devich. He's the owner of a title company in Baltimore. He told WMAR2 News in May that during the ransomware attack, his company was unable to record any home purchases or sales.
My heart is beating out of my chest. You know, as a small family business, 16 years in Baltimore City, I don't know what the next 10 minutes will be, let alone the next 3 weeks.
I'm speaking with Frances Robles of the New York Times. She's written about these attacks. And joining me now from Tulsa, Oklahoma, is Tyler Moore, professor of cybersecurity and information assurance at the Tandy School of Computer Science at the University of Tulsa. He's also the director of Stop Badware, a nonprofit and anti-malware organization. You can link to his recent op-ed on ransomware for the Washington Post at our website, onpointradio.org. Tyler, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Glad to be here.
So we're just talking about how this wreaks havoc on cities around the country. What makes city governments so vulnerable to malware attacks?
Well, cities are an attractive target for a number of reasons. So first of all, they have lots of data that provides key services to citizens, and citizens have an expectation that they're going to have access to those services and it will be available. So they become an attractive target that way. Cybersecurity and government systems at all levels of government, but especially at the local level, frequently lags that in the private sector because budgets are tighter, but also because procurement cycles are slower, so it's harder to keep up with the pace of innovation, and the staff pay is unfortunately lower too.
But practically speaking, how do hackers carry out these attacks, these ransomware attacks? How does it happen?
Well, it varies from attack to attack, but essentially there is some way that an attacker can install malware, malicious software, onto a computer system. And at the first stage is often untargeted. They're just trying to get a foothold somewhere. It could be clicking on a link in an email that takes you to a website that will distribute the malicious software. It could be opening an attachment. But once they're in, they will then try to move and see what other computers you're connected to. And in the case of the malware that affected Lake City, it appears that the malware actually tried to see what kind of target they had hit. Only in the event that they found an enterprise that looked like a city did they decide to then go ahead and encrypt the files.
And are these foreign hackers? Who are these people?
We don't know the Florida hackers in this case yet, but we're looking back in history, we know that they typically are. So two Iranians were charged in the ransomware attacks on Atlanta mentioned earlier. There have been other ransomware attacks targeted to citizens in North Korea. So North Korea, Iran, Russia is where a lot of these attackers seem to be.
So the decision of to pay or not to pay, how does that calculation work? I mean, Atlanta refused to pay $51,000 in extortion, and gosh, they've lost millions, right?
Absolutely. So it's a very tough call. I mean, from the perspective of an individual city, doing a narrow cost-benefit analysis, the benefits tend to outweigh the cost because the criminals are likely to give you your data back. It might take a while, but you'll get it back. And it's really the only way to do it. And so from that calculation, it's better to do it. But when you take a step back and think at the societal level, it's not so obvious. It's, in fact, paying the ransom has a lot of adverse effects. I mean, it means that this is a viable attack, and so more and more cities are going to be targeted. And like we just said, you end up paying characters in countries that are often under sanction that you wouldn't otherwise want to be providing sources of hard foreign currency.
And Frances Robles, the FBI encourages cities not to pay hackers' extortion demands, but yet some do.
Well, one thing that's really important, I'm not sure the cities that decline to pay, I don't know that it's a moral stance. I think it's a lack of insurance stance. So in Baltimore, we know that they didn't have the insurance. I think that plays a huge factor into it.
Let me get a call in here. Michelle is in Plainfield, Vermont. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the program.
Hello, this is Professor Cave from Norwich University, and I've been doing information security for 40 years. I want the message to everybody, including individuals, not just cities, make offline backups. That means you back up your information at a frequency that reflects the importance of its being current, and you store the backup medium away from the computer so it cannot be encrypted by ransomware.
Professor, thank you. Tyler Moore, is that possible for cities and towns? Is that actually realistic?
So the advice is to make backups, and he makes a good point in that you can't just stop there because, in fact, Lake City had backups in place, but they were online network backups, and the ransomware spread to there. And so making backups and storing copies of sensitive data offline or on separate networks, or using cloud services that will store archival copies for you that cannot be deleted. You have to actually go further than just making backups. You have to actually make a more informed backup decision.
Anna is on the line from New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Anna. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I think you all might have just answered my question, because my question was, can't they protect themselves by storing their data in the cloud?
In Lake City, they're now going to be paying about $32,000 a year for a cloud service. And the IT director got fired, basically, for not having more of those protections in place.
Does it make a difference, Tyler, where you store, where you back up?
So putting in the cloud can help, but it's the feature that's important is that the cloud service provider needs to store archival copies of backups and not allow you to delete those backup copies. And so if you just have a bog standard cloud service provider, you need to make sure that that feature is enabled.
And Frank from Twitter tells us, test your backups regularly. Know what your recovery process is. Follow the 3-2-1 rule. Three copies in two places, of which one is off-site. Tyler Moore, approve?
Yeah, I mean, so I think a lot of this comes down to the need for basic cyber hygiene. And so it's you know, at the point the ransomware is installed, then backups can help you recover. But you also need to have automated patching so that your systems can't be infected in the first place. And so you have a series of failures that enables the ransomware to take hold and then the backups to not be there.
So, Francis Robles, do governments, do hospitals, do private corporations, I mean, what does it take to fend off these attacks? From your reporting, what have you found?
Well, one thing that they're doing now that clearly is a little too late is a lot more training of the employees. At the New York Times, I get emails all the time that are spear phishing emails like, hey, take a look at this document, and you're supposed to click on it. And if you click on it, you end up getting a message from our own IT department that says, hey, dummy, you know, you shouldn't have opened that. Maybe they're a little bit more diplomatic than that. And so you're going to see a much more robust effort to educate everybody. Don't click on every single attachment that you get, even if it looks like it's coming from a source that you trust.
Tyler Moore?
So, yeah, user training is something that people turn to. The research is mixed on that and shows that it may only be, it's at best partially effective. And so you have to have a robust strategy where maybe you train your employees, but you also have processes in place to try to detect when someone clicks on a link they shouldn't and try to prevent the malware from spreading, and also, again, investing in a robust backup strategy that's resilient to ransomware.
Francis Robles, you were a correspondent in Colombia in South America, and I'm curious, after seeing, you know, and covering ransom and kidnappings in that part of the world, what can we apply in these situations from what you learned there?
Well, it's interesting that you should mention that, because I brought that up in my interviews in Lake City, and I don't think they liked the analogy. But I told them that when I was based in Colombia, you know, most of the correspondents had at least discussed, and if not put in writing, their personal philosophy on ransom. And so I remember very clearly when a photographer that I worked with, Scott Dalton, and another reporter had been kidnapped. I remember the reporter, I don't remember the photographer. They had already put in writing to their families, if I'm ever kidnapped, don't pay the ransom. Mm. And the implications of that is very clear. You know, let me rot in the jungle or let them kill me. Because many of us felt that the more that this ransom is paid, you were basically inviting more of your colleagues to spend the next decade in the jungle. And so if you felt really firmly about it, you put that in writing. And so I belong to this really wimpy club of people that felt so firmly about it that I told my family but did not put it in writing because I knew they weren't going to honor it anyway. And so I sort of left a door open that maybe I'll change my mind if I'm ever kidnapped. But it also reminds me of the investigation that the New York Times did about ISIS. And what it showed was that ISIS was being funded by the ransom that the European governments were paying. And so the American government was not paying. So the Americans were being kidnapped at a much lower rate. And those who got kidnapped got murdered. Mm. You know, so, you know, it's a really tough decision. Are you willing to put, now, obviously, you know, nobody, I don't think the mayor of Lake City was going to be murdered, but, you know, that's, you know, you have to, it's a really, right. really big sacrifice right. that you're making right. in the sense of, for morality of, oh, on principle, I don't believe in paying ransom. Okay, well, then do you believe in paying $17 million like the city of Atlanta is about to have to incur in costs in recovering all your data?
Professor Moore, that's really interesting, right? I mean, jump in here, because in your Washington Post op-ed, you cite instances of ransomware going back to 2006, but they're becoming more and more pervasive. So that decision to pay or not to pay, is that playing into this, to the increase?
Well, I think absolutely. I think that, you know, cyber criminals do what makes them money, at least the profit-motivated one. When they find a playbook that works, they stick to it, and they found that cities seem to be paying. And I think, you know, establishing a norm to not pay is really one of the key long-term countermeasures that we need to be considering. It's very hard to do because every city has their own decision to take. But one thing that's kind of interesting from Francis's reporting is this notion of insurance and the role it plays. And I think one thing we maybe could consider is whether or not insurance should be allowed to pay ransom. In this case, you know, we know that in the case of other instances of cyber insurance with data breaches, for instance, in some states, fines cannot be covered by fines for a breach cannot be covered by the insurance policy. And so the fact that insurance is in premiums are being paid out here could actually making the problem worse than it actually is. And so that could be a coordinated way in which we might take the air out of some of these ransom amounts.
By the way, we asked the FBI to join us today. They declined, but they sent this statement, which reads, "The FBI encourages victims not to pay a hacker's extortion demands. The payment of extortion demands encourages continued criminal activity, leads to other victimizations, and can be used to facilitate additional serious crimes. Additionally, paying a ransom does not guarantee the victim will regain access to their data. The best approach is to focus on defense in depth and have several layers of security, as there is no single method to prevent compromise or exploitation." So, Professor Moore, just a couple of minutes left here. Is there any action on the federal level to address these concerns, these ransomware attacks, and what these cities and municipalities are dealing with?
Well, some things are quite encouraging. So, in the sense that the two Iranians behind the Atlanta attacks were charged, right? And so I think one of the things that's sort of underappreciated in the sort of the fight against cybercrime generally, not just for ransomware, is that law enforcement has a very significant role to play, and I don't think we're investing enough in fighting cybercrime at that level, because many cybercriminals feel quite rationally that they can act with impunity. They can carry out these ransoms and get away with it most of the time. And so if we can actually make that more difficult and root out some of the crime there, then that will deflect criminal activities towards other areas. And so I think that's one of the key areas in which we can make a real difference, is really putting more emphasis on beefing up our anti-cybercrime capabilities.
How do you see it, Francis Robles?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that there's only one solution here, and that we have to protect ourselves. You know, you don't protect, you know, in your house, if you don't want burglars to come in, you don't just get really good, you know, renter's insurance. You put a lock on the door.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, for your information, for your time, for helping us understand this vexing problem for a lot of cities and towns across the country that are losing millions and millions of dollars. Francis Robles, correspondent for The New York Times. You can link to her recent piece, headlined, "A City Paid a Hefty Ransom to Hackers, But the Pains Are Far From Over." That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Francis, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Jane.
And Tyler Moore, professor of cybersecurity and information assurance at the University of Tulsa. He's also director of Stop Badware, a nonprofit anti-malware organization. You can link to his recent op-ed on ransomware for The Washington Post. That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Tyler Moore, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justin Daum, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poley, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.